Yet the German imperial government persisted in its course. If the submarine wasn't doing all that had been expected, and if the armies of America gathered like a thundercloud, yet Russia was definitely down, and in October the same sort of autumn offensive that had overthrown Serbia in 1915 and Romania in 1916 was now turned with crushing effect against Italy. The Italian front collapsed after the Battle of Caporetto, and the Austro-German armies poured down into Venetia and came almost within gunfire of Venice. Germany felt justified, therefore, in taking a high line with the Russian peace proposals, and the Peace of Brest-Litovsk on March 2, 1918, gave the Western Allies some intimation of what a German victory would mean to them. It was a crushing and exorbitant peace, dictated with the utmost arrogance of confident victors. All through the winter, German troops had been shifting from the eastern to the western front, and now, in the spring of 1918, the jaded enthusiasm of hungry, weary, and bleeding Germany was lashed up for the one supreme effort that was really and truly to end the war. For some months, American troops had been in France, but the bulk of the American army was still across the Atlantic. It was high time for the final conclusive blow upon the Western Front, if such a blow was ever to be delivered. The first attack was upon the British in the Somme region. The not very brilliant cavalry generals, who were still in command of a front upon which cavalry was a useless encumbrance, were caught napping, and on March the 21st, in Gough's disaster, the 5th British Army was driven back in disorder. The jealousies of the British and French generals had prevented any unified command of the Allied armies in France, and there was no general reserve whatever behind Gough. Thousands of guns were lost and scores of thousands of prisoners. Many of these losses were due to the utter incompetence of the higher command. No less than 100 tanks were abandoned because they ran out of petrol. The British were driven back almost to Amiens. Throughout April and May, the Germans rained offensives on the Allied front. They came near to a breakthrough in the north, and they made a great drive back to the Marne, which they reached again on May the 30th, 1918. This was the climax of the German effort. Behind it was nothing but an exhausted homeland. The Allied politicians intervened in the quarrels of their professional soldiers, and Marshal Foch was put in supreme command of all the Allied armies. Fresh troops were hurrying from Britain across the Channel, and America was now pouring men into France by the 100,000. In June, the weary Austrians made a last effort in Italy and collapsed before an Italian counterattack. Early in June, Foch began to develop a counterattack in the Marne angle. By July, the tide was turning, and the Germans were reeling back. The Battle of Château Thierry on July the 18th proved the quality of the new American armies. In August, the British opened a great and successful thrust into Belgium, and the bulge of the German lines towards Amiens wilted and collapsed. Germany had finished. The fighting spirit passed out of her army, and October was a story of defeat and retreat along the entire Western Front. Early in November, British troops were in Valenciennes and Americans in Sedan. In Italy also, the Austrian armies were in a state of disorderly retreat, but everywhere now the Hohenzollern and Habsburg forces were collapsing. The smash at the end was amazingly swift. Frenchmen and Englishmen couldn't believe their newspapers as day after day they announced the capture of more hundreds of guns and more thousands of prisoners. In September, a great Allied offensive against Bulgaria had produced a revolution in that country and peace proposals. Turkey had followed with a capitulation at the end of October, and Austro-Hungary on November the 4th. There was an attempt to bring out the German fleet for a last fight, but the sailors mutinied on November the 7th. The Kaiser and the Crown Prince bolted hastily and without a scrap of dignity into Holland. On November the 11th, an armistice was signed, and the war was at an end. For 4 years and a quarter, the war had lasted, and gradually it had drawn nearly everyone in the Western world, at least, into its vortex. Upwards of 10 millions of people had been actually killed through the fighting. Another 20 or 25 million had died through the hardships and disorders entailed. Scores of millions were suffering and enfeebled by undernourishment and misery. A vast proportion of the living were now engaged in war work, in drilling and armament, in making munitions, in hospitals, in working as substitutes for men who had gone into the armies and the like. Businessmen had been adapting themselves to the more hectic methods necessary for profit in a world in a state of crisis. The war had become, indeed, an atmosphere, a habit of life, a new social order. Then, suddenly, it ended. In London, the armistice was proclaimed about midday on November the 11th. It produced a strange cessation of every ordinary routine. Clerks poured out of their offices and wouldn't return. Assistants deserted their shops. Omnibus drivers and the drivers of military lorries set out upon journeys of their own devising with picked-up loads of astounded and cheering passengers, going nowhere in particular and careless whither they went. Vast, vacant crowds presently choked the streets, and every house and shop that possessed such adornments hung out flags. When night came, many of the main streets, which had been kept in darkness for many months because of the air raids, were brightly lit. It was very strange to see thronging multitudes assembled in an artificial light again. Everyone felt aimless, with a kind of strained and aching relief. It was over at last. There would be no more killing in France, no more air raids, and things would get better. People wanted to laugh and weep, and could do neither. Youths of spirit and young soldiers on leave formed thin, noisy processions that shoved their way through the general drift and did their best to make a jollification. A captured German gun was hauled from the Mall, where a vast array of such trophies had been set out, into Trafalgar Square, and its carriage burnt. Squibs and crackers were thrown about, but there was little concerted rejoicing. Nearly everyone had lost too much, and suffered too much, to rejoice with any fervour. 10th. The world in the year after the Great War was like a man who has had some vital surgical operation very roughly performed, and who isn't yet sure whether he can now go on living, or whether he has not been so profoundly shocked and injured that he will presently fall down and die. It was a world dazed and stunned. German militarist imperialism had been defeated, but at an overwhelming cost. It had come very near to victory. Everything went on, now that the strain of the conflict had ceased, rather laxly, rather weakly, and with a gusty and uncertain temper. There was a universal hunger for peace, a universal desire for the lost safety and liberty and prosperity of pre-war times, without any power of will to achieve and secure these things. Just as with the Roman Republic after the long strain of the Punic War, so now there had been a great release of violence and cruelty, and a profounder deterioration in financial and economic morality. Generous spirits had sacrificed themselves freely to the urgent demands of the war, but the sly and base of the worlds of business and money had watched the convulsive opportunities of the time and secured a firm grip upon the resources and political power of their countries. Everywhere, men who would have been regarded as shady adventurers before 1914 had acquired power and influence, while better men toiled unprofitably. Such men as Lord Rhondda, the British food controller, killed themselves with hard work, while the war profiteer waxed rich and secured his grip upon press and party organization.